Good evening, everybody. Welcome to our live chat for the night, live chat 4 of HCI 490. I'm going to get our PowerPoint pulled up and we will get started. Just a reminder, if you are attending live, please feel free to keep yourself on mute just to cut down on background noise so everybody is able to hear. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, feel free to unmute yourself, or you are more than welcome to type it in the chat box. I do monitor that throughout the evening. If you are watching this as a recording, feel free to reach out with any questions you may have. My email is here on the screen, but you are also welcome to reach out to me over Messenger, through phone, or by text. So feel free to reach out. So tonight we're going to go over a review of Unit 3 topics. We're going to be covering some very important dates that we have coming up. We're going to go over our Unit 4 topics, uniform assignments, and then some tips for success. So like I mentioned, if you have any questions, feel free to reach out. I see no one is on yet. So if you think of any questions when you are watching this recording, feel free to reach out with any questions you may have. Last week, we went over 3 main concepts, the first being clinical decision support systems, CDSS. They are essentially tools that are put into an electronic health record to help make better quality medical decisions for patients. And these can be something as simple as recognizing patient allergies, all the way up to alerting a provider that a patient is due for a preventative measure. All of these are very important when it comes to providing quality patient care. And there's some pros and cons to them. We talked about some of them last week. We talked about some in the discussion boards. But it's one of those things, like a controlled medical vocabulary, that it requires maintenance. Somebody not only has to know how to use it, but how to keep it up to date. Additionally, we have some providers that feel that it takes away from their autonomy and their decision-making process, because instead of allowing them to have free rein, you're giving them a list they need to check off. Additionally, some providers feel that they have enough alerts, enough notifications, that it just ends up getting overwhelming to them. So there are pros and cons, because ultimately it does help to provide better quality patient care when being used effectively and appropriately. We also talked about interoperability and how none of that would be possible without HL7 and FHIR. These are the two primary languages that are used for interoperability at this moment. Interoperability is the ability for electronic health record systems to share information between each other. So something, for example, like electronically sending a script to a pharmacy is the result of interoperability, sharing records between providers, sending lab results back. These are all elements of interoperability. So ultimately, interoperability is allowing us as healthcare providers, healthcare administrators, to provide better quality patient care and more complete patient care, because we are having a full picture of information and the data is almost real time. So that is one of the great benefits, is that we are not having to wait for results to be sent. We're not having to wait for medical records to be sent. Because if you remember back in the days when we used paper charts and paper records, you had weeks and weeks for copying, processing, mailing. I mean, could you imagine trying to mail a medical record right now in the current speed that the USPS system is moving? It could be quite a while. It's also pretty costly, especially for a patient who has been a patient at a practice for a long period of time or has a complex record with specialists, any of those types of things. Because not only does it need to be mailed, it also needs to be mailed in a secure package. Because if you're just putting it in a brown envelope, the risk of it being opened in the mail and therefore violating HIPAA is a high risk. We also talked about vendors. So we went over a few different vendors last week. But one of the things that we wanted to focus on is the fact that not every vendor is going to meet the needs of every healthcare organization. A great example of this is Point-Click Care is in a great electronic health record system, but it is great for the specialty it works with. It is great for long-term care facilities, inpatient rehab facilities, assisted living facilities, anywhere that a patient is going to be staying at least overnight, not in a hospital setting, but in a lower level of care. So these are just some things that we want to keep in mind as we are thinking about vendors for the project, but also whenever we go out into the real world, what kind of software vendors are available for the type of practice we are working with. I work for a outpatient primary care provider that has a behavioral health element and some social service elements. A system like Point Click Care would not be effective for us. We are still small in size, with not a huge budget, a mid-sized budget. So a behemoth that is expensive like Epic may not be a solution that fits for an organization like that. And that's something that you want to make sure you're taking into account, not only, like I said, for the project, but also whenever you are making these decisions as a electronic health record guru, the super user, the consultant, whoever you are in that project, that you're taking a look at that. So we're going to go over some important dates, and I'm going to spend a decent amount of time on this just because of the fact these are very, very important dates. If you can believe it, we are in week 4 of this class, and this is a 5-week course. For some of you, this might be your last class. For some of you, it's your second to last class. But either way, I'd like to make sure that you understand these dates coming up. So our last day of this class is July 12th, which is right around July 17th. Wow. Sorry. July 17th, which is right around the corner. Definitely not July 12th. July 12th is during week 5, and it is a Wednesday. July 17th, it is the last day of our class. That being said, no assignments can be submitted after 11:59 p.m. Central Standard Time on July 17th. Now, there is an exception to that, and we'll get there in just a moment, but you want to make sure you have all of your work submitted by that date. If there is something that has happened in your life that pops up, that occurs, that is preventing you from getting everything in by that date, let's have a chat. So CTU uses something called an incomplete. And a lot of students freak out when they hear the phrase incomplete, because some schools use it that you take it incomplete and you retake the course and the new grade replaces the incomplete. That is not the situation here. An incomplete at CTU gives you 5 extra days to complete the coursework. So let's say, for example, you have an extenuating circumstance, you've been sick, you've been caring for a family member who's been sick, there's an emergency, you've been impacted significantly by these wildfires or these storms. It's one of those things that if you and I have a discussion because you have something that's coming up, I'm a reasonable person. So everybody's going to have something that's a little bit different, but those are some examples. We're going to have that talk. We're going to set up a game plan to make sure you are set up for success. And we can get you those 5 extra days. If you think you would benefit from those 5 extra days, I would much rather you apply for them and not need them than need them and not have them. Because on July 14th at 11:59 p.m. Central Standard Time, that is the cutoff to apply for an incomplete. So by July 14th at 11:59 p.m., through a CTU-approved form of messaging, so either through Messenger or in my CTU inbox for email. It can come from your personal email, but it needs to be in my CTU email. There needs to be a request that states, I am requesting an incomplete because insert reason here. So because I've been sick, because the wildfires impacted my health, whatever your situation might be. It is important that you have both of those, because just saying you need an incomplete is not a full application for this incomplete. So if you think you're going to need it, it's better to apply early. And it's better that if you might need it, that you apply for it and not need it. Because I can submit your grade still at the normal time if you're able to get everything in. I have had students before that they have requested the incomplete, got everything in just in time for the end of the course, and we processed their grade as if they hadn't had an incomplete anyways. So it is very, very difficult to get an incomplete approved after the fact. I've been teaching at CTU now for almost 3 years, And it is, I've gotten two approved at this point. So it is a challenge to get that taken care of after the fact. Because you have to have an extenuating circumstance of why you could not apply. So if you have questions on whether or not you qualify for an incomplete, if an incomplete would benefit you, the process for applying for an incomplete, again, because this is such a unique circumstance for every person, please reach out. We'll have a discussion about this and we can go through that application process for you. But again, it does need to be in writing. It needs to be in a CTU approved form of messaging. So either Messenger or my CTU email. And it has to have that you are requesting an incomplete and the reason why by July 14th at 11:59 p.m. Central Standard Time. Let's say, for example, you do not apply for an incomplete and you get all your work in. Your grades will be posted by July 19th at 11:59 p.m. Central Standard Time. So again, last day of the course, if you are not applying for an incomplete, is July 17th. Grades are posted 2 days later at 11:59 p.m. If you have questions about where your grade is and it is before 11:59 p.m., I promise you it is coming. I try to get them done early. It doesn't always happen because, you know, life happens, unfortunately. I've had times that my power goes out, my internet goes out, my own personal illness, all sorts of things. So just a little bit of patience. If you have questions about your grade, though, don't hesitate to reach out. Now, as I mentioned, July 14th is the deadline to apply for an incomplete. Just because you are applying for an incomplete does not mean that it is approved. So please keep that in mind. If you are granted an incomplete, you have until July 22nd at 11:59 p.m. Central Standard Time to submit your work. So that is five extra days after the initial cutoff for the course. And if you were granted an incomplete, your grade will be posted by 11:59 p.m. Central Standard Time on July 24th. I'm going to be posting these dates into the classroom shortly after this class. So if you have questions about these, do not hesitate to reach out. I'd be more than happy to go over this with you. Again, it is such an individualized thing that having that discussion is usually better. So if you think you could benefit from it, let me know and we can talk it through. Any questions from anyone who is on at this moment? I know I heard at least one person hop in. Yes, we got one person in. Julius, did you have any questions while I'm on here at the topic? Okay. So tonight we're going to be going over a few different topics when it comes to legislation in healthcare. We got a few different ones that we're going to be going over tonight, but there are other pieces of legislation that exist in the healthcare realm. So things like the PPACA, Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, HIPAA, high-tech, patient identifying information breaches, and then there's a whole bunch of other information, especially pertaining to genetics and research as well. We're not going to be going over those tonight in our class, but there is information in Muse about these because these are becoming much, much more common right now in the world of healthcare as genetic research is being done on a much more like outpatient, over-the-counter basis. So things like 23andMe and those types of like Ancestry.com DNA testing. Because all of our DNA essentially is floating around somewhere, there is legislation in place to help protect people. And same thing with research. So with those, a lot of times you can opt into research, but there are obligations by the researcher to make sure everything is ethical and protected and de-identified. So there's a whole bunch of things related to that. So first off, we're going to be talking about the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. This is known as a lot of things. PPACA is the official acronym, but a lot of times it is shortened into ACA, or Obamacare. So the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act is relatively newer legislation overall, but it had three main benefits that came through it for consumer healthcare. The first is preventative care expansion. Previously, health insurances did not have to cover preventative care measures. So things, for example, like an annual gynecological exam, those were not covered by most insurances. I remember when I was younger, my gynecologist was only covered every 3 years under my medical insurance. And not even just the pap smear part, the actual exam was only covered every 3 years. So it was a lot of struggle. And even then it had a copay. So there was a lot of issues with that. It was up to the insurance to decide these things. Under the Affordable Care Act, things like preventative care measures have no copay associated with it. So if you are on a health insurance plan that is under the Affordable Care Act guidelines, preventative care measures like vaccines, regular screenings, annual physicals, if you are on a Medicare plan, a Medicare wellness exam, they are not going to have a copay associated with those elements. Now, if you are coming in for a problem-focused visit or a sick visit, those ones are going to end up having a copay associated with it. But overall, just a regular visit is not going to, preventative care visit is not going to. The Affordable Care Act also worked to set the framework for Medicaid expansion. We recently had a Medicaid expansion that went away, but that is above and beyond what the Affordable Care Act facilitated. So providing Medicaid to individuals who qualify is a very important thing. Medicaid overall is a great safety net and a great tool for individuals who need it. The Affordable Care Act being implemented, it actually expanded eligibility and allowed for more individuals, especially in more conservative states, to be able to receive Medicaid coverage. Recently, we just went through Medicaid expansion under the public health emergency. And as the public health emergency ended in April, that expansion was rolled back. So those are two separate expansions. The Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act has not been rolled back, but the Medicaid expansion under the public health emergency has been. And some important designation between the two of them is while they both focused on expanding the number of individuals who receive Medicaid, the more recent one under the public health emergency also removed the requirement to renew benefits while we were in the public health emergency. And on the surface, this is a wonderful, great thing because during a pandemic, during a public health emergency, remembering to reapply for your benefits can be a problem because you have other priorities, especially in the early days of the pandemic when finding groceries, making sure you're paying your bills, all those things were much, much higher priorities than things like filling out a piece of paper to apply for Medicaid or reapply for Medicaid. So that is a great thing. But at the same point in time, when the public health emergency ended, all of the requirements of Medicaid came back into the world. So effective when the public health emergency ended, you have to renew your Medicaid benefits on your annual basis. For many individuals who've been on Medicaid for a long period of time or who work with Medicaid, this is not a huge issue. However, I am one of the individuals who ended up moving during the public health emergency 3 times. As such, my address has not been the same. And as I mentioned during course one, I am an adoptive and foster parent. And our adopted daughter has Medicaid insurance through the state because she is adopted through foster care. And I did not change her address. How many other individuals did not change their address for everyone who benefited from the public health emergency Medicaid expansion? Had I not remembered to change her address when her Medicaid renewal packet came, it would have been sent to the wrong address and then returned because mail forwarding does not last that long. In which case, I would not know that her Medicaid was due for renewal and her Medicaid would terminate. So it creates a huge issue because how many individuals have transient housing, are unhoused, have moved, have a different address than what they did whenever they last did a Medicaid renewal. For these individuals, whenever their renewal is due, this Medicaid expansion rollback is going to be problematic. We're going to have many individuals that are going to lose Medicaid coverage because of a change in address. Because for some people, it's been 2.5, 3 years since they renewed their benefits. So it can be problematic there. But one of the biggest things that came out of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act is protection for individuals with pre-existing health conditions. So prior to the Affordable Care Act, if you had a pre-existing condition, and pre-existing condition is very loosely defined because there is a list that you can find online that lists, I think it's about 5 pages of pre-existing conditions. And they are things that are everyday run-of-the-mill conditions that can be treated with medications. So for example, asthma. I know many individuals that are well controlled with asthma that may have a flare up and have to use their inhaler from time to time, but they have a diagnosis of asthma. And under that, that's technically considered a pre-existing condition. Pregnancy is considered a pre-existing condition. Diabetes, hypertension, high cholesterol, many autoimmune disorders, endocrine disorders. There's all sorts of different diagnoses on this list that most individuals have. And what this pre-existing condition clause in an insurance gave the insurance the right to do is if a patient had a pre-existing condition, the insurance had 2 options. They could either charge more for the insurance than a healthy individual, or they could refuse to insure that individual. And that was at the discretion of the insurance plan. So Blue Cross could make one decision, United Healthcare could make a decision, Aetna could make a decision, and they could all have different price points because while Blue Cross may say, no, we are not insuring this patient, United Healthcare might say, yeah, you know, we'll insure them for $1,200 a month for that individual alone. And Aetna might say, yeah, we'll insure them for $900. So it becomes a process of trying to find insurance, or if you're unlucky, you're not finding any insurances, or you're finding really poor quality insurances. The Affordable Care Act removed this ability. So plans that are under the guidance of the Affordable Care Act cannot designate part of their plan and pricing under pre-existing conditions. So if you are an individual with a pre-existing condition and your plan is under the Affordable Care Act, you cannot be denied for coverage under that pre-existing condition or charged more than your comparable peer for the same benefit of insurance in the same zip code and that sort of thing. There are different things where insurance may cost more if you're in a different zip code or different county. So a little bit of a comparison shopping there, but they can't charge more than your hypothetical peer in the same demographics. We talked in Unit 2 about the importance of HIPAA. We went over the different penalties, the different fines, the jail time associated with them. Here is HIPAA-CAT. So just as a reminder, HIPAA is the Health Insurance Portability and Protection Act. An important thing, that is not the correct acronym. Sorry, my memory is a little slow today. Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. There we go. Sorry about that. So HIPAA essentially is making sure that we are keeping information for patients private. An individual who doesn't have the right to know a patient's information doesn't need to know that information. And that is ultimately what the civil level is. So this is protecting patient information from willful neglect, hackers, any of those types of things. Whereas the criminal penalties are more along the lines of selling information or just being having blatant disregard for patient information. An important thing to know about HIPAA is when HIPAA was originally written, there was no electronic health records. So that is where part of HITECH came in. HITECH is the Health Insurance Technology for Economic and Clinical Health Act, HITECH. HITECH essentially created penalties for HIPAA violations through electronic health record systems. Because when HIPAA was written, HIPAA did not have to worry about electronic health records. They just had paper records. And obviously there's only so much you can do with a paper record. A hacker can't come in through your copy machine and take all the information there. They can't come in through your carbon copies of papers, any of those types of things. But they can come in through your firewall. So there had to be a way to protect healthcare providers, healthcare patient information from that electronic element. So HIPAA, as it was originally written, did not cover electronic health records. HITECH allowed for it to do that. And an important thing to note is HIPAA is spelled H-I-P-A-A. It is not H-I-P-P-A. And I will tell you, it is an extremely common mistake, because even the CEO of my organization will sometimes type it incorrectly. So just keep an eye on that, because it is important that you do spell it correctly, because it changes the acronym a little bit. HITECH also incentivized EHR adoption, because when EHRs first came out, there was a huge barrier for providers to adopt it. They were going from paper to an entirely electronic record system. So not only are they needing to spend money on the software, because we discovered software is not inexpensive, and the hardware and the internet and the security and the storage, but we're also having to spend time, not just the time to train people, but also any downtime created by system outages, downtime created by the implementation process, downtime created by having to pull paper records to transfer in. Because if you have ever had to take a price quote for the cost of transferring paper to electronic health records, it is a pretty high cost, and it is a pain to do by yourself. So it's important that you're taking all of these costs into effect. HITECH worked to create incentives for healthcare providers to early adopt to healthcare electronic health record systems. So it helped to lower some of those barriers. It wasn't perfect, especially in the beginning, because there weren't quite as many options as there is now, but it was a helpful element. So we also have PII and PHI. PII is personal identifying information, and PHI is personal health information. I personally like to talk about PII as anything you can Google about yourself. So if you go and type your name into Google and you put a quotation mark at the beginning and the end, anything that you can find about yourself on there is personal identifying information. So you might find addresses, both current and former addresses, phone numbers, current and former, employers, current and former. You might find all sorts of things, who you might be associated with, your spouse, any of those types of things. It is personal identifying information. Personal health information is the more private type thing. So maybe your health insurance, your diagnosis, your lab results, your office notes, those types of elements that are associated with your personal health care. It is not something that you are going to want disclosed on the internet. I mean, some people don't really care about their personal health information because there's nothing remarkable. Or if it is something remarkable, it might be something they're very open about. So for example, a lot of people who have cancers that do like charity walks, they might be open about the fact, yes, I have this diagnosis of cancer, those types of things. And this is a very important distinguishing factor when it comes to HIPAA. So HIPAA protects the health information, but the personal identifying information, it's usually good to disclose when those types of elements are involved in a breach. So for example, many years ago, I worked for a specialty practice where one of the front office individuals emailed a patient's intake sheet to another patient, because she named the file incorrectly. These types of things happen. It had the patient's name, date of birth, address, phone number, email. I think it may have had like their employer, but not much more than that. There wasn't a whole lot of information on it. So when we found out about this, we contacted our legal counsel, who coached us through it, wrote a letter to the patient. We reached out to the patient, said, hey, this is what happened. Here's a letter letting you know what happened. We disclosed it just to be safe, to kind of cover our butts. Nothing ever came of it. The patient understood that accidents happen. It wasn't anything severe. And his response was, well, you can find all that information about me online. It would have been a much different situation if we had disclosed perhaps the patient's labs or the insurance for that patient, any of those types of elements. So it's really important that even if it is something that's as benign as personal health information, that we're keeping our patients protected. Ultimately, one of the biggest risks we have as healthcare entities that use electronic health record systems is information breaches. Ultimately, an information breach is when an outside entity attempts or successfully accesses information from our system. So if an information breach is occurring, the first thing you want to do is remove the affected device from the network. The organization I used to work for, I was working remotely for after I moved out to Philly. I still had my work computer and I was working on it for one night. IT didn't tell me that they were going to be doing any work with it. So I'm just plugging along, doing my work, and all of a sudden my mouse starts moving and I'm freaking out. So I try taking it back thinking, okay, maybe the computer's just doing something and it has a delayed response with the mouse. No, it starts moving again. Now, obviously my computer is on a desktop, so I cannot just unplug it. I end up holding the power down, shutting it off. I call IT in a panic. I fortunately have the head of our IT department's cell phone number in my cell phone. And I call him almost in tears. I'm freaking out. I'm like, something's wrong with my computer. Please tell me it was you. And he's like, calm down. Yes, it was me. Sorry, we probably should have told you we were going into your computer because we know you work weird hours. But yes, ultimately removing your affected device from the network any way you can, removing the battery, turning it off, unplugging it. You don't want to, especially true with desktops, you don't want to put the computer in sleep because that does not remove the computer from the network. As an IT person, the IT person is going to be checking the audit and logging systems to see what happened, what went wrong. We're going to start changing all the passwords of the affected systems. And this is going to, we're going to be talking about phishing a little bit later on, but this is included things like email, electronic health record systems, the server, the computer password, all of those things. You want to change the passwords and make them unique. You want to make sure you're having secure passwords. So things like, for example, password one, not your best bet, your dog's name, your cat's name, your child's name, any of those things, they're not the best things to have as part of your passwords because they are easier to guess. You also want to try to make sure that you have separate personal and work passwords. IT is going to start an investigation of what happened and determine the root cause. How did the person get into the system? What did they do to get in the system? What was their way into the system? Did they send an email that somebody opened? Did they hack into the system? Did they access the firewall? Did somebody put a flash drive in the system? How did they get in? They're going to then outline the next steps on what's going to happen, how it's going to happen, and when it's going to happen. And then you're going to communicate your plan both internally and externally. And an important thing, especially when it comes to employee relations, is you want to make sure that your employees are hearing it first prior to sharing it to external resources, because you want to make sure your employees are informed and also that they are coached if they're going to be the individuals who are going to be taking phone calls about it on how to respond. Because especially when it's some of these large scale breaches, you're going to have a lot of very, very angry people. So how are you going to train your phone staff on how to take those calls? I think it was about a year ago, maybe two at this point, where Kronos was hacked by ransomware. Kronos is a timekeeping system that resulted in a lot of people not getting their paychecks. And a lot of employers blamed Kronos. So a lot of employees got very angry and were calling Kronos. So making sure that you have coached your staff and you're providing support to your staff on what to do when angry customers, angry patients are calling in, how do you direct them? What supports can you provide? Those types of things, because they're upset. And it's a reasonable expectation their information has been compromised, not accessible, any of those types of things. So you want to make sure that your staff is aware of what to do prior to it going public. And this may mean you're bringing on additional staff or reallocating resources to support that increase in demand. So as I mentioned, we're going to be talking a little about phishing, about vishing, and text message phishing. We can also talk a little bit about things called juice jacking and the use of flash drives. So first up, we're going to talk about phishing. Phishing is, with a P, is the attempt of a unfriendly third party that wants your information to send you an email that looks completely innocent, that looks like a normal run-of-the-mill email, in hopes that you're going to click that link and give them your login credentials or your bank information. And sometimes they look really convincing. I get one on a regular basis from HR at myorganization.org, except for the fact I know that we don't have an email that is HR at myorganization.org. Our HR department has their own individual emails, and there isn't actually one. So some things to look for in these emails. The first thing is urgency. So the email that's right here on the screen, if you notice, it says your password's going to expire in one day. Your password expires in 24 hours. Please follow this link to update your password. Now, this may be a legitimate issue. I get these emails from time to time where, yes, it is, your password's expiring in 2 months. Your password's expiring in 2 weeks. If the first email you get says your password expires tomorrow, fix it now, that is usually a cause for a red flag. Because if it is something that important, they're going to be giving you notice leading up to it. Your password expires in a week. Your password expires in 5 days, 2 days, those types of things, not just 24 hours before. This one right here, if you notice, it has some other red flags to it. So from some user at memphis.edu to you, dear students, faculty, and staff, this email is from Memphis Information Technology Services, ITS. Please kindly verify your memphis.edu email within 24 hours or your email will be temporarily suspended. Click here to verify your email. Memphis.edu IT Help Desk. So I'm going to point out some things here. Our little red bubbles here show some things. So first off, we have that threat. Your email is going to be turned off within 24 hours. If this is the first you're hearing of it, that's a bit concerning. This is saying it's a trusted sender. If you hover over a link in an email, it's going to tell you where it's taking you. And in this case, click here to verify your email. You would assume that it's taking you somewhere for memphis.edu's website. And when you hover, it has a completely different website associated with it. Another thing is they don't always use the same verbiage. So Memphis Information Technology Services, ITS. Memphis.edu IT Help Desk, two different names. Additionally, it ends with a comma. I don't know any departments that end with a comma unless you have like a title after your name. So for example, someone who has a PhD might put comma PhD after their name. So just some things to be looking out for. Additionally, a lot of these emails are coming from people who are not English as a first language speakers. And kindly is a word that is very commonly used for these individuals. So a lot of times it is a red flag when you see kindly in an email that it is not a legitimate email. So some other things to look at whenever it comes to those emails, strange characters. So for example, you get some sometimes that they'll have like the C from the French language that has the little five below it. I forget what it's actually called as the C. Might have exclamation points instead of I's. There's all different ways that people will replace symbols with letters because that way at a quick glance, it looks legitimate, but it truly isn't. So those are just some things to look out for. But the big thing is they want you to act impulsively. You're going to see some grammar errors. You're going to see some inconsistencies. And those links are not accurate. If you ever have any questions on whether or not an email is legitimate, Send it over to your IT department and say, hey, I think this might be phishing. Can you take a look and let me know if it's legitimate? Because sometimes emails may come over that look illegitimate, that look like a phishing thing, and they are real emails. I got one from my IT department at one point in time that was from a person at the IT department that I have never spoken to. And being somebody who worked in health informatics, I knew everybody in that IT department. It was a secured email with no content, and the subject was just secured email telephones. I had no idea what it was about. I sent it over to the IT help desk. I'm like, I think this might be phishing. I don't know who this person is. It's a secure email. I'm not opening it until you tell me I can. They let me know, yes, this person really does work for the organization. You just haven't met them yet. So I was able to open it. It truly was about telephones. That's wonderful. But it was one of those things that I would rather ask the IT department and know than not ask them and open an email that infects the system. An important thing to point out, though, is if you watch any major medical drama that is on TV right now, they're going to have some sort of episode about phishing. The one I remember the most is The Good Doctor. The Good Doctor is on, I want to say ABC. I get them all confused. It's on one of the primetime channels. And it is about a doctor who works at a hospital. The doctor is autistic. He's a surgeon. But in this, and his girlfriend, wife, fiance, I'm not quite sure what she is at this point in the series, works in their IT department. And somebody opened an email for a phishing attack. The system gets taken over completely. An IT tech, not the girlfriend, spilled coffee on the server, so all the backups are lost. And somehow or another, in like the 11th hour, she pulls it off and recovers all the data, because while the systems are down, they have no access to any records. All the systems are locked. They are a super high-tech hospital, so many of their imaging is down. Their surgical units are down because they can't do imaging. They can't access patient charts, all sorts of issues. So something as simple as opening an email, you want to make sure that you are making smart choices with. Now, this here is an example of text message phishing. I have two different examples up here, and they're two very common scams that are used in text message phishing. The first one on the left, again, you're going to see a lot of those things that we pointed out in those emails. So, dear Bank of America, dear customer, Bank of America is closing your bank account. Please confirm your PIN at website here that looks illegitimate to keep your account activated. When these are sent out, they are mass sent to people, regardless of who their bank is, because they're casting a wide net in hopes to catch one or two people. You may not have a Bank of America account and you're getting this text message. It's one of those situations where they're just casting as wide of a net as they can. If you ever get one from your personal bank, do yourself a favor and call the number on the back of the card to make sure that it is not a true attempt by your bank to reach out to you. Typically, they're going to tell you, no, we're never going to send you that kind of message, but it's better, again, to hear it from the horse's mouth than to try to investigate it yourself by clicking that link. Because in this case, it's not patient information, it is your bank account information and your money. So it's usually a good idea to investigate these things. On the right is a very, very common scam that goes through. I've seen it through email, but text messaging is one of the more common ones right now, where somebody who claims to be a close contact to you is reaching out asking you to buy gift cards or to send them money or anything like that. So on the right, hi, Roberta, it's the dean. Are you there? Yes, how are you? I'm not feeling well. I've got a cold. How are you? And where are you? I need a quick favor. Do you have Zelle and have you used Zelle before? And then a minute later, I need a quick favor. Do you have Zelle? Have you used Zelle before? 3 minutes later, Roberta, are you there? Sorry, you have a cold. I am really good. Sorry, what can I do for you? I need you to do a Zelle transfer to one of the advisory board representatives, as I need her to pick up a few items for the dean's office. So again, we have that urgency. We have that pushing. Hey, I need this. I need this. Where are you? Why aren't you responding? I see this commonly as a Facebook scam as well. And it's one of those situations that if this person truly is somebody who would be reaching out to you to get information, if this truly was the dean and the dean is your boss, give the dean a call and be like, hey, I'm getting this text message from you. Are you okay? Is everything fine? I had a situation once where a patient's email got hacked and we started getting emails at the provider's office I worked at that was like, hey, I need it. I'm stuck in a country. I need a Visa gift card. Can you send that to me? And I will pay you back when I come in for my visit on Tuesday. The person who hacked into the email got access to the patient's calendar, saw that they were coming for an appointment on Tuesday, were able to verify all sorts of information about the patient. But at the end of the day, when we called the patient had no idea any of this was going on. So the patient changed his email password and was able to secure everything, no damage done. So it's one of those things, always think before you act, especially whenever you're trying to click a link or send money. And then vishing is essentially the same thing, but you are calling the person, trying to gather information, banking information over the phone, getting people to give their bank information to you by claiming that you're somebody else. A really common one that I hear for this is people claiming to be the IRS. About 2 years ago or so, I got all sorts of angry phone calls and voicemails claiming to be from the IRS, that they were going to put me in jail and all that kind of sort of stuff. So that's fun. Another one that a lot of people will get preyed on, especially the elderly population, is they will get a call from somebody claiming to be from a jail that has their grandchild, and they'll play a clip of the grandchild talking or saying something, any of those types of things. And it's a way that a lot of elderly people will send money to criminals, essentially, that can result in these types of things. So when in doubt, make sure you're investigating it. If it's a text message, a link, a phone call. I think the first time I got that IRS call, I freaked out. I remember logging into my IRS account to make sure. But I can imagine somebody who didn't know how to do that might just call that number back and be like, yes, here's my money, please don't arrest me type situation. So always make sure you are thinking things through and using your best judgment. So this week, again, we have a discussion board. Our discussion board is due Thursday with peer responses due Saturday. I highly suggest working on this discussion board as soon as you possibly can, especially the feedback, because this is going to be part of your IP4. So you are going to write a cover letter for your request for proposal and review the cover letters prepared by at least two of your classmates. You're going to continue to utilize the scenario that was provided to you. You're going to draft a cover letter, and you're going to use it for your individual project. It's going to be a one-page cover letter that is sent along with the request for proposal to the vendor for the information. If you need help with writing a business letter, you're going to go to the Learning Center in the classroom, choose Writing Support, click on the Writing tabs, go to Workplace Writing, and then choose Letter. It's going to look something like this. Here's Letter. And right here, we have three different examples regarding formal business letters. So this is all in the Writing Center. It's a great tool to use. An important thing, though, is if you are using the template for the business letter, that you make sure to remove any boilerplate text. Now, in a real-world situation, you would not be using references in a professional letter. However, because we are still in school, it is important that you are using at least two references and you are citing them according to APA guidelines. So that's going to mean in-text citations and references at the end of the letter. That can be a second page, but you do need to have two references. That's very important. So again, here's the letter section. There's some templates. Now, this week for Unit 4, for our IP, you're going to be having part of that cover letter be implemented. So first up, this breaks into two parts. You are going to be taking all of the sections you have written for IP 1, 2, and 3, and you are going to combine them together in a cohesive document. So part one, you're going to compile that information. You're going to have an introductory paragraph for what the plan is about, what you are discussing, and why it is necessary. You're going to put all your components of the plans into one document. Make sure you address the readiness assessment, benefits, any implementation issues. You're going to go over the overall project of the plan, the organization. So you're going to talk about the organization, the migration path, plan for communication to stakeholders, and change management. At the end, you're going to have that recommendation of vendors section that we went over for IP3. You're going to be saying who the vendors were you considered. Remember, you picked at least two vendors that you were going through. What vendors did you research? Why did you pick those vendors? What considerations went into picking them? And then finally, what vendor was selected and why you selected them? So all of that you have done in IPs 1, 2, and 3. Part 2 is new content. So now that you've selected a vendor, let's say, for example, you picked Epic to supply a replacement EHR vendor for the clinic, you must submit a request for proposal. The request for proposal is a valuable tool that is going to be used to provide detailed requirements to vendors to give them guidelines during the bidding process. The RFP is a solicitation to a vendor to provide information that helps them make a decision on which vendor to choose for the new EHR. So essentially, you are writing this request for proposal and this cover letter as a, hey, look at this. This is what we have. This is what you need to know about us. Epic, please work with us, that type of thing. We'd love to hear from you. And an important thing, especially in that cover letter, is that you go over the high level things. So we are Yorkshire Clinic. We have X number of providers. We have X number of patients. We are an outpatient care provider that does telehealth and on-site provider care. We have whatever you might have that's important. Your needs, your wants, those types of things, that you have those high-level items. And there's two reasons here. First off, if I am a salesperson for a software, I want that commission, but I also want to make sure that you are picking a product that we can meet your expectations for. And what I mean by this is if you want telehealth to be embedded hypothetically into the electronic health record system, and my electronic health record system cannot provide that, that's something I want to make sure you know, because that way we are managing expectations. We may have a workaround system. You may be using Doxy, or you may be using something else, but we got to make sure that you know these things. Similarly, as I mentioned before, not all healthcare providers are the same. It's not a one-size-fits-all model. So even though the software may work for different size organizations, we may have different teams that work with different size practices, because the lift of converting a large hospital-wide network from one system to another is much, much higher than converting a single office practice from one system to another. So you want to make sure not only that we've managed the expectations, but also that you're assigned to the right team of people. So you want to make sure you hit that in your cover letter and also in your request for proposal. So the first part of your RFP is going to be your cover letter with a general description of what is requested and what needs to be in the system. So what do you need them to cover? What do they need to know about Yorkshire? It's important that you have that in the cover letter. The second part is the proposal that the vendor would fill out to complete and cover the following. What qualifications does the vendor have? So general background of the vendor, experience, number of installations, financial stability, and so forth. Proposed solution, how the vendor believes its product meets the organizational goals. General contractual requirements, warranties, payment schedules, penalties for failure to meet the schedule specified in the contract. That's important. And so forth. Pricing, the quotes, utilization, so on and so forth, clinical decision support systems, and other administrative tools. So you are going to fill out this part as if you are the vendor, using the information that you have found from the vendors. It may not be 100% correct, because you may not know the payment schedule, but you are going to make a payment schedule up for that vendor. So some tips for IP4. First off, make sure that you are starting your discussion board as early as you can, giving feedback to other people. Give the quality of feedback that you would like to receive. So if you would like to receive constructive quality feedback, make sure you're providing that. Be sure to consider all your needs and barriers you identified in IPs 1 and 2. Be sure the knowledge gathered from the vendors in IP 3 are used in this as well. And make sure you are using APA formatting, not just in the content, but also in your cover letter. Again, it is an academic letter. Be sure that you are using references. So some tips for success. If you think you might need an incomplete, let's talk about it. Because again, I would much rather you have an incomplete and not need it than need one and not have it. So again, your situation is unique to you. Only you know your situation. So if you think you might benefit from it, please reach out to me as early as possible so we can get that taken care of for you. It helps to reduce your stress, especially as the term is winding down. Because like I mentioned, we are in week 4 of 5, which is, it's flying. Discussion boards. Start your discussion board early. Make sure you're providing that feedback to others. And then finally, use your previous assignments, IPs 1, 2, and 3, and the feedback that's been provided on them as a foundation for IP 4. If you have questions, please do not hesitate to reach out. I'd much rather give you feedback or guidance now than having you be scrambling at the last minute. So other than that, that is everything we have this evening. Did anybody have any questions? If not, you are
no
free.
Question.
All right, perfect. Then you are free to go. Have a good evening.
You as well.
Thank you.
Okay.